Alopecia, I'm sure you've heard of. It's a skin condition where you lose your hair. Now, it can be patches here and there, or it can be what's called alopecia totalis, where all your hair disappears. Now, I can name two famous people with alopecia. One is comic actor Matt Lucas from Little Britain, and what's the baking show? The Great British Bake Off. He was the host of that for a while as well. And, you know, he's alopecia totalis, no hair on any part of his body. He doesn't have eyelashes or anything anymore. Another person, famous person with alopecia, is the leader of the federal opposition, Peter Dutton. That's what happened to his hair. He's not just bald, he's totally bald. Like, you know, no eyebrows, no nothing going on. And that's why, because he's got alopecia. Dermatologist Professor Rodney Sinclair is working on it because it can be pretty distressing to get alopecia and suddenly have chunks of your hair go missing. Let's find out the latest about that. Good afternoon, Professor Sinclair. How are you?
Very well. Good afternoon.
Now, a little bit about alopecia. Sort of how and when does it turn up for patients?
Well, it can pretty much begin at any age. So most people tend to get it in their late teens, early 20s. But some children start to get it at 4, 5, 6, 7. And some people don't get their first episode until they're in their 50s and 60s. So it can occur almost at any age.
Oh, what do you think is the worst time for it to happen? I think in your 50s, you're enough of a solid person that you can cope with it most likely. Is it worse to happen when you're 20 and just when you're interested in the other gender, it suddenly becomes quite difficult for you?
I think it's difficult at any age. I mean, even a 50-year-old woman who suddenly loses all her hair for the first time can be absolutely devastating. A man, on the other hand, might be able to pass it off as ordinary male pattern baldness, and so it's not disfiguring in the same way as it is for a woman.
Yeah.
But children, often when they get it at a very young age, they're not really aware of it, and so they don't have the insight, and they don't notice that other people are reacting to them differently. And it's quite interesting because with the children, once we regrow their hair with some of these new treatments, the parents often say they suddenly start getting invited to birthday parties and play dates, and they didn't realise they'd been excluded. And so it's only when the hair grows back and they're no longer excluded that they realise that there was all this other activity going on around them.
Oh,
that they were
wow.
missing out on.
Now, what do we know about the causes of alopecia?
Well, we know that it involves two factors. So one is that there's a genetic predisposition. So you've got to have the right genes to make you vulnerable to developing this. And so far, 18 genes have been identified that make people susceptible to alopecia. But no one's got all 18 of those genes. Most people have 4 or 5 of them. And so it's the number of genes you've got, the combination and the type of genes you've got that determines what your overall vulnerability is. But you've got the same genes all your life. So in addition to the vulnerability, there's also got to be an environmental trigger. And there used to be a lot of confusion about this. People used to blame stress and lifestyle and diet and things like that. And we're now very confident that we can exclude any of those as being important factors in alopecia. And the trigger seems to be a viral infection. And what we know is that when you get a viral infection, your body makes interferon gamma. And that's one of the protective chemicals that we use to fight the infection. But the interferon gamma also has this funny effect on hair follicles that makes them susceptible to autoimmune attack. And so it seems to be the intercurrent viral infection that can be the trigger. And what we've all learned with COVID is that you can actually have an infection and not know that you've had it. So people can test positive for COVID even though they had no symptoms. And that's the same with pretty much any virus. And so we're all getting exposed to viruses every day, every week, every month that we're unaware of. But the body's immune system is combating it so that all of this is happening in the background. And it's part of that fight against those otherwise insignificant viral infections that you're making interferon gamma that's increasing your vulnerability to alopecia if you've got the genes that make you vulnerable to it.
Right. That's fascinating. A viral attack is the issue. You know, and you're absolutely right. We are bombarded with viruses and bacteria every day, aren't we?
Well, that's right. You know, some of them cause a distinctive rash and they have a name like chickenpox or mumps or measles. Some of them have characteristic symptoms. Others are just really nonspecific and you don't even know that you've got it most of the time.
Now, how common is alopecia?
Well, it's actually the most common autoimmune disease in man. So it's much more common than juvenile diabetes or autoimmune thyroid disease or rheumatoid arthritis, a lot of those conditions that are household names. And alopecia is actually much more common. There's probably about 500,000 Australians who will get alopecia at some point in their life.
Oh, wow, that is common. And you do hear of the, you know, occasional big names who've got it. Like Christopher Reeve, the man who played Superman, apparently had some alopecia going on as well.
And Peter Garrett from Midnight Oil, a number of footballers. You know, it's interesting. Often you don't notice it because the women will conceal it. They'll tie their hair back in a ponytail, or they'll wear a wig, or the men will shave off all their hair, so you think it's just a male pattern baldness alteration. But it's certainly out there. There's lots of it around.
Now, where are we in finding reliable treatment or even a cure for it?
Well, what spun out of identifying those 18 genes is that we could look at certain genes belong to certain families of molecules. And as a result of that, they were able to identify treatments that were already in existence largely that were being used to treat other conditions that could also be beneficial for alopecia. And so the first big breakthrough was with a medication that had been used for 10 or 15 years for rheumatoid arthritis. And that's now been approved by the TGA in Australia. It's been approved by the FDA and the regulatory authorities all around the world. And that's now able to be prescribed in Australia, even though it's not yet reimbursed. And so we've now got highly effective treatments designed specifically for alopecia areata that have been extensively tested in alopecia areata. And they're very good at regrowing the hair. But what we know is that there's a phase in the alopecia where it's receptive to treatment, and there's a phase where it becomes refractory to treatment. And the longer you've had the hair loss, the harder it is to treat. And so we know that there's a window of opportunity, particularly within the first couple of years, when people get the alopecia, where it responds best to these treatments.
Right. So someone like Matt Lucas or Peter Dutton, who have had that for years, the follicles are gone and there's not much chance of getting them back.
They're not gone, but the immune system seems to reinforce and become entrenched in terms of the way in which it responds. And so it's much harder to get them to grow. Sometimes you have wins and they do regrow all their hair, but once they've had it for a long time, it becomes, you know, the likelihood of responding to the treatment gets lower.
I can see why rheumatoid arthritis medication would work, because rheumatoid arthritis is an immune system problem too, isn't it?
Well, that's right. When you look at these 18 genes, a lot of these genes are repeat offenders. So the same genes pop up in thyroid disease. They pop up in vitiligo, which is another skin disease. They pop up in diabetes. They pop up in a whole range of these other conditions. So they've got this shared component to them that increases the risk of different types of autoimmune diseases. But those genes on their own aren't enough to cause the alopecia. It's got to be combined with other genes.
You are listening to ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. Dermatologist Professor Rodney Sinclair is with us talking about his work on alopecia. What's the work you've been trialling recently? What's the drug that you've been trialling most recently?
So we've been working with a number of these agents over the past 5 or 6 years. And in fact, our clinic in Melbourne's probably the largest alopecia areata clinic in the world by almost an order of magnitude. We're probably 10 times bigger than the next biggest clinic in the world in terms of the number of patients we treat and the experience we've got in using these medications. And so we've worked with about 5 or 6 different medications that all belong to this family called Janus kinase inhibitors or JAK inhibitors. And we've had in our clinic probably 600 patients who we've treated with these agents, and overwhelmingly it's been a success. Now, obviously, there's some patients who don't respond. It's the same with any medication, but overwhelmingly, it has been a success. And what we're now doing is we're extending these trials into children. So when they first developed the medications, they limited the trials to people aged 18 and over. And so the medication that's registered in Australia, baricitinib, is only available to be prescribed to adults. And so now they're doing the trials initially in children aged 11 to 17, and then in another 6 or 9 months, we're hoping to start trials in children aged 5 to 10, because, of course, the FDA, the regulator in America, make it a condition on these pharmaceutical companies that if you have a medication that treats a disease and the disease affects people of all age groups, then you can't discriminate against one particular age group and not do the testing on them. But, of course, you can't license it in children if you've only done the testing in adults. And so these companies are under an obligation when they have a medication approved for a certain age group and that disease occurs outside of that age group to also conduct trials so that no one is discriminated against on the basis of their age.
If everything goes well, when are the young people going to be able to get that medication?
Well, I suspect it will happen very quickly, because now that the medication has been approved, really what the regulators are now looking at is, does it have effectiveness in this age group? And what we're actually already starting to see is that the children often do better because they haven't had their disease for as long. And so we're getting at the children earlier in the phase of the disease. They're getting very good responses. And the other good news about this condition is that if you continue the medication, then the alopecia won't come back. So you can actually make it go away and make it stay away. And from a safety point of view, these medications were originally designed for diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, where it was intended that they'd be taken lifelong.
Yeah, you have them forever.
So we've got a lot of comfort with the safety of these agents, and we know that if you continue to take them, they're going to continue to work.
Dermatologist Professor Rodney Sinclair has been our guest, talking about the advances they're making in the treatment of alopecia, which I can imagine can be quite distressing. It wouldn't worry me so much if I started getting bald spots. I'd just shave my head. I'm a guy over 50. We all go that way eventually.
It's actually very interesting, because we did some surveys, and what we found is that people, when you look at how does this impact your quality of life, it can be quite difficult to score, because it's hard to say what difference it does. But when you talk to young people and say, if you had to live with your alopecia for the rest of your life and your life expectancy was 80, would you be prepared to trade a couple of years so that instead of living to 80 bald, you could live to 79 with hair? And they'd say, absolutely. And say, 77, yes, 76. Some of them were giving up 30 years of life expectancy in exchange for a full head of hair, because even though they couldn't articulate how it affected them, it intruded on every aspect of their life, every social interaction, every work interaction. It felt as though there was something unspoken, that there was a secret that you couldn't communicate, that people didn't want to talk about, they were embarrassed to talk about. And certainly in terms of establishing relationships, maintaining relationships, all of those things, the hair is really, really important to how we feel about ourselves and how we get on with our work and our play.
Professor Rodney Sinclair from Sinclair Dermatology has been our guest. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.